on merit. If that system can find me innocent, then it can find him guilty. You won't have legitimacy unless you do it, Ixion says, panting. What kind of bitch commander can't even finish the job? For all I know, he's right. But I also know I've learned the hard way what kind of leader I want to be. And if I can't be that person now, I might as well be back in that cell. I step forward. Your helmet. The arena is so quiet. My voice echoes on the stone stands. Proof of a match won. Ixion's visor is raised. His eyes are wide with disbelief. He tears off his helmet, and for one mad second, I think he's going to hand it to me without protest. Instead, he tosses it to the ground. He yanks his boots free of their charred stirrups and slams his heels with such force into Nita's side that Nita lurches. Fire, you stupid! Before I can say a word, Ayla's fury ignites. In two bounds, she leaps forward, knocking Ixion off his broken storm scourge and driving him into rubble-strewn ground. Her rage courses through us. For Pala before, for Nita now, blazing into a single violent purpose. This is the dragon's punishment. Through her pricked ears, I hear the snap of Ixion's spinal cord as his head connects with rock. Ayla lifts her head, her eyes finding mine, and her pupils narrow to slits as she extricates her mind from mine. Her flared nostrils and her glare are enough to make clear. I had my business to settle with Ixion, but she has hers, and it follows its own laws. He lies strewn across the stones like a rag doll, a pool of crimson spreading from his head in a terrible halo. Blood spilled in a pool like Palor's was. Though she's attempting to keep me out, her satisfaction does not fail to trickle into me as she smells it. A pattering sound is distant in my ears, rising in pitch from the stands. Are they cheering? Ayla's fangs are poised to sink into Ixion's jugular, to feast. When I snap to my senses and step forward, palms lifted. Ayla, that's enough. It takes effort to get the words out through our widening, salivating jaws. The audience's cheering only grows louder, as if her bloodlust is spilling into them too. But that's their prerogative. And this is mine. Ixion's death will have dignity. It's over. The Kallipolans' cheering is drowned by Nita's rising howl. A widow cry. Even with his rider's cruelty as a final farewell, the bond's breaking causes him sorrow. He's turned his head, surrounded by his battered, tent-like wings, to take in his fallen master from where he lies broken in the rubble. In the corner of my vision, the officials have hoisted up the chain link and are carrying it toward us. Their eyes are on Nita. I lift a hand. The officials and the net pause in their advance. Nita stretches a trembling, broken wing over the body of his rider, mantling his corpse. For a moment, as Ayla and I watch his heaving flank slow in its gasps, the emotion that flits between us is pity. The Kallipolans' bloodthirsty cheers have fallen silent as the dragon's keening sorrow fills the arena. We have had our revolution, but this storm scourge? He had no such liberation. Nita deserved better than Ixion too. The storm scourge lowers his head into the crook of his broken wing as his breath slows. And then I look around for what feels like the first time. At the arena, its breath held. at the shadowed wings of the Goliathan and the clover riders circling overhead, at the officials waiting to the side of the crater, and above us, at the palace box where Freyda will award the laurel. I realize that I'm shaking. I can feel, suddenly, the pain of the burns, the flight, the cramps and the blood sticking my flame suit to my thighs. I'm in desperate need of coolant, a shower, and a meal. As I sway, I hear a new chant swelling from the stands, soft at first, but growing louder, this time not with an epithet, but a title. Antigone Sua Ayla, First Rider. About bloody time, I think, with strange exasperation. And that's when Obizuth lets out an earth-shaking roar and rears.
41. The Leveling. Dilo. I hardly spare eyes for Ixion and Antigone's match. So busy am I searching the horizon for a sign. Not that the duel isn't satisfying. I've had this feeling at a tournament once before, when Ixion competed against his sister, Julia. Then as now, you had the sense that history was about to be rewritten. But my chief concern remains the Basileian prince I was introduced to in Ixion's parlor. Fordruk is here. So where is his dragon? The males are supposed to be even larger than the females. As Jephira and I circle with the clover fleet, we scan the vista below. The fire mouth's empty. Pythos keep flattened by Obizuth's nesting, and the wide boulevards of High Market are clear. The river is still and engorged. There's no sign of another dragon anywhere below, much less one the size of a whale. Is it possible Freudric came by sea, not by air? Ayla and Nita rise, plateau and plummet. Like a twisting, flaming comet, they fall. The sound of their impact on the arena floor reverberates within its walls. Finish it. Ixion's voice pops distantly in my ears. Ayla fires into the sky. And then, I look again. A river, murky with spring runoff, engorged. Becca's drawing of the great dragon submerged below a blue line. That's how it sneaks up on you. Titus Greyheather is on my wing, and I yell to him. Titus! It's the fur! But he's not listening to me. A collective shout of horror, bordering on titillation, has gone up from the bastards surrounding me. They crane their necks over the dragon's wings. I glance down. Ayla crouches over Ixion, who is spread-eagled. Nita lets out a widow cry. Ixion's dead. I test my feelings and draw a blank. There was a time when Ixion and I were friends, but it was on the other side of a revolution. I've been mourning that friend for as long as I can remember. This just finishes an overdue job. I'm still looking down at Ixion when the river Fur erupts. A Goliathan twice the size of Freyda's parts the water as it arches upward. A wall of water sloshes over the side of the arena onto Obizuth. Barges tumble onto the upper and lower banks like little bricks. A horned head turns on the female with fangs bared. It lunges. At the same time, from cypress groves at the base of Pythos' keep stream, a fleet of dragons like an erupting flock of birds. The resistance riders have summoned. The dragons are already saddled. They weave through the flailing Goliathans like sparrows evading hawks and dive into the arena, searching for their riders. When they emerge, it's with guardians and woad riders on their backs. Just as they, as we, planned. D'Lo! Grifser Sparker is the first of them to join my wing. What the hell is this thing? Around us, the bastards from the Clover Fleet are staring. Peasant lover, Titus says. Still, whatever way I imagined coming clean, I don't think it was in the air with two wrestling Goliathans in between me and the ground. I lift a shoulder, catching Griff's eye, and he grins. Yeah, I say. Still. Then I explain to Titus and Griff both. Froedrich's here. I think Azuleth's trying to subdue his mate. In the arena below, crowds of Kallipolans are churning as they scream and push for exits, seeking safety from the great dragons. As we watch, the male Goliathan seizes the female by the crested neck and gnashes. Her roar of fury shakes the stones. His wing is already mantling hers, his bristly talons sinking into her flank. Maybe we should let him. Griff sounds dubious. Makes our job easier if the whole point is to get her out of here. Titus splutters. The whole point? What the hell kind of plot is this? Before anyone can bother to explain it to him, another voice joins ours. I've got a better idea. Antigone Saw Ayla has risen to Griff's side. Her visor is up, her eyes wide in an ash-blackened face. Forget the female. Target the male. I'm going to find Freda. She wheels Ayla round and Griff shouts after her. To do what? Annie calls over her shoulder as she yanks down her visor. To give her my terms! After she's dived into the turmoil below, Griff and I stare at each other. Corsa Marana has arrived at his wing, and Titus Greyheather's still at mine, spluttering. The rest of the Clover Riders are facing the resistance in midair like we're setting up for a melee. Griff squints down at Azuleth. His horned tail lops the roofs of several manors in the Jelliculum as it flails. Antigone's bonkers. We haven't trained to take on a mere Goliathan. That thing's beastly. Could you do it with backup? Griff looks up at me. And then, cottoning on, he glances down the row of glaring Clover Riders and flashes his most ingratiating smile. Hiya, folks, he says to the Dragonborn, with a luxurious use of the informal. When we were kids and he tried this, he was beaten for it. Titus looks from him to me, his teeth gritted. You've got to be joking. I jab a thumb at the girl disappearing into the fires below. Antigone Saw Ayla just proved herself first rider and fleet commander of Kallipolis. Unless you or any were thinking of challenging her for that title. I lift my voice. The Dragonborn look at each other. No one volunteers. As unchallenged Alternus of the Kallipolan fleet, second in command to Antigone, the next order is mine to give. Then do what Griff says. Griff looks about as smug as I've ever seen him, and that's saying something. He begins to pair his riders off with mine, passing out the lines to thread through harpoons. I'm about to take a harpoon myself when I have a better thought. There's a tether target to take care of, and I know exactly where to find him. Where are you going? Griff shouts, as I nudge Jephira into a dive. I'm going to neutralize Froedrich.
Lee. The stands vibrate with Obazuth's screams. Horns the length of a human body split the stones and pierce the dragon's hide as Azulith bites Obazuth's crested neck. A monstrous, cruel transformation of the same familiarity I watched Palor perform on Ayla. All around me, Kallipolans get to their feet and push for the exits, screaming. As the tide of terrified citizens pulls me with it, I realize what's wrong. The guards, a mixture of Kallipolan and Basilean, are directing people out the main exits. These will lead into the courtyards of the Great Palace, the public gardens, and the Janiculum neighborhoods, which are still more exposed. Overhead, the first harpoon thwacks into the side of Azulith, and then the putt-putt-putt of the target line follows as the riders begin their encirclement. The Goliathan's furious roar produces flame as thick as a pillar. The upper floors of the inner palace catch fire. A horned wing slams down at a turret, explodes like chalk. When I lower the arm I've raised to shield my face, I glimpse a pair of narrow amber wings wheeling under the flames. Antigone Soela lands on the empty stone row above me. "Lee," she says. "Annie!" She's raised her visor and is beaming, her ruddy face smeared with ash and sweat, and she's absolutely gorgeous. "I'm going to find Freda, will you come?" She indicates the space on the saddle behind her where I could squeeze in. But I look at the citizens scrambling down the stairs around me and find myself shaking my head. "I think I'm needed here." Last time, she was the one who said this to me. We're both grinning like idiots now. "Then I'll find you after," she says, and resets her visor. Ayla kicks off from the ground, and I begin to elbow through the crowd. When I find the nearest guard, I seize him as I point into the heart of the arena. "You need to evacuate everyone into the Firemouth. The upper bank is about to be leveled. It's safer underground." The guard wipes a sweating brow. He's barely older than I am, and I recognize him. At a dinner party, long ago, in the war college, he bragged about his brother's feats in the revolution and toasted my name. "Bad idea," he says, barely glancing at me. "They get lost. You do your job, I'll do mine, citizen." "I'm trying to." That gets his attention. He lifts his cap to squint at me, and his roving gaze travels from the scar across my face to my eyes. "Lee Sorpalor." "Gavin, tell them to make for the Firemouth and tell them to follow me." Gavin's eyes are wide. I may as well be a ghost. As far as anyone in this city knows, I'm dead. When he reels in a breath and lifts an arm, his bellow is as loud as a crier's. "Make for the Firemouth! Follow Lee Sorpalor!" Though there will be a time to discard the Draconim, it isn't today. The whispers alight through the throngs as they divide before me. "Lee Sorpalor's alive!" I lead them into the bowels of the Firemouth.
Griff. I used to take pride in Sparker's formidable size, but these beasts put that in perspective. It takes all the teams we have, Clovers and Guardians and Woad Riders together, to snare Azulith. When we start to tighten, and finally his fangs release Obizuth's neck, the female falls gasping on top of a fancy neighborhood at the foot of Pytho's Keep and flattens it. A lot of rich folks' houses have been knocked out today. Wonder what Dilo will think of that. Where is he? He went to find Freudrich a half hour ago. Our riders are tightening their ropes, binding Azulith in place, and now that his wings are restrained, they'll muzzle him to stop the fire. I toss my next harpoon to Bran and dig my heel into Sparker's side. "Griff, where are you?" "I'll be right back." We head for the high turrets of the inner palace as fast as Sparker's big body can go. As soon as he catches the crackling lightning over water scent of a skyfish, we dive. The grill locked across the inner palace's entrance to the Firemouth has been torn open by the Goliathan's struggles. What's left of the towers is on fire. We find Jaffira on a balcony three levels down, scampering back and forth as she attempts to squeeze herself through the human-sized door. Dilo is nowhere to be seen. Sparker tugs Jif aside with a gentle nip of his gums, and as I dismount, I hush her with a quick pat to her flank. "I'll find him, darling." I step into the smoking darkness. "Dilo?" Silence. Flickering red light comes from the end of the corridor, where a door swings slowly on its hinges. As I make my way toward it, my boots crush broken glass. Somewhere above us, a goliathan thrashes, and the reverberations through the stone of the palace ripple the ground beneath my feet. Dilo? Inside the parlor, the chandelier hangs sideways, its glimmering crystals strewn across the floor like frozen teardrops. Flames lick up the drapes. In the center of a smoking rug, half covered by a tea table, lies Dilo. Is he wounded? Unconscious from the smoke? Or surely not? It's unthinkable. Panic grips me. I launch forward, shouting his name. After all I've won and lost, not this, too. Not my Dilo. I'm two steps into the room when something slams me to the ground. Fingers close around my neck. A chinless face, lost in black veins, fills my vision. I pound a fist into Froedric's side, but the tethering lends him inhuman strength. He catches my fist in his and begins to crush it as if the bones were made of chalk. His teeth are bloody.
"You're that abomination," he growls, in a voice that contains many voices, so deep it vibrates through the ground. "The slave with the dragon."
"Technically a king these days, but yeah, I've got a dragon." He spits bloody saliva in my face, and then he's growling, his black eyes squeezing shut.
"Come to me. Come to me."
And I realize he's not talking to me anymore. He switches to Basilic, his voice rising as if chanted by a whole chorus of princes. With a deafening crunch, as stone cracks and metal splinters, the stone ceiling over our heads parts. Sunlight and clouds of mortar pour through. When I look up, blinking, it takes me a moment to understand what's descending into the opening. A glow from within a great maw illuminates fangs the length of my body. I'm staring up at Azulith's open mouth. Harpoon lines hang off his horns like so many broken threads. Our riders are flitting around him, shouting and panicking as the Goliathan seeks its tethering rider. Froedric throws his head back and laughs. And from out of sight, Bran's voice calls, "Heave!" The lines dangling from Azulith's maw tighten as they are regained, pulled by riders out of sight. The great jaws begin to close. The fiery glow dwindles to fluttering sparks that rain harmlessly down. From behind Froedric, a hand appears, holding a brick. It clocks him on the side of the head. Froedric slumps sideways, off me. Behind him crouches Dilo, panting, bleeding from the ear, but grinning like an idiot. Above us, Azulith blinks as if only now noticing the sunlight, his flared pupils slowly drifting back to their usual slits. His maw is cinched shut.
"Wind up,"
calls Kor's voice, and the ropes begin to circle.
"Were you trying to rescue me?" Dilo asks. I'm grinning a bit myself. "I mean, you're my damsel."
Still holding the brick, Dilo leans forward. For a half second, I wonder if he's going to hit me in the head with it too. I'm pinned under the dead weight of the unconscious Basilean prince.
"I'm not the one with Goliathan's slobber on my face," Dilo says.
He's smirking. I wipe my face in horror. And then, before I know what's happened, Dilo leans forward and kisses me, slobber and all. I'm so surprised I nearly forget how to kiss him back. But I remember fast enough. Bran's voice interrupts.
"A little help finishing this up, lads."
He's circling the still disoriented Azulith in the haze above us, a chain in hand connecting to a Goliathan-sized muzzle.
"Yeah, all right, all right."
Dilo pulls the unconscious prince off me, and we go to finish the job we started.
Annie. I find Freda slumped atop Pytho's keep. Whether she instinctively climbed the winding stair to take refuge in her dragon's nest, or hoped to summon Obizuth from this safe vantage point and flee, she can do neither now. On the crumbling remains of the bank below, Azulith struggles vainly as my riders tighten a muzzle around his maw, but he's done enough damage. Obizuth lies across the flattened geniculum, panting from her wounds. Even if Freyda were to summon her, I'm not sure she'd be able to rise. But maybe Freyda mounted the steps of Pytho's keep for a different reason. I find her kneeling on the edge of the sky court, surveying the wreckage below as if contemplating the drop. She has a hand to her neck where Obizuth was bitten, as if her own body feels it. Her brother has come for her, and she's lost her one way out. Callipolis has turned on her. At least part of that feeling, I know. I slide from Ayla's back as soon as her talons hit the ground. Wait! Freyda twists. She's torn off her veil. Her darkened eyes find me, and the black strings at her neck seem to choke her. Antigone, she says in her many-throated voice. I approach and curtsy in the way appropriate to equals. The formal address I use is not Basilia's, but Callipolis's. Your Highness, I would discuss our terms. I wait for her black eyes to regain their white rims. Then I make the proposal in dragon tongue. As you see, my fleet has trained to bring down a Goliathan. We brought it here today to confront Obizuth. Instead, we protected her from the onslaught of your brother's dragon. If you wish it, we can widow Freudric now. Or we can escort him and his dragon, subdued, back to Varsk. Why? Freyda asks. She hasn't gotten up from the edge. Why do you offer this favor? Because I want something in return. Not until Azulith closed his jaws around Obizuth's neck did I see it. Freyda came to Callipolis to back a change of power. But she is not the only one with power to bring to the table now. What if we did it the other way around? What if we backed her? If you demand a change to the succession practices of Basilia, to claim the throne of the God King, and your brother and father oppose, we can help. Let us be your guarantee. Let us accompany you to Varsk to demand the birthright your sex denies, without the marriage you abhor. As you saw today, we have the fleet to ensure it. Freyda's chest is heaving. You would do that? I nod. In exchange, you will remove your ships from our shores, forgive Callipolis's debt, and renounce any right to our vassalage. I've stretched out a hand. Freyda's slow smile spreads, and then it falters like a hatchling in first flight. They would never let me have it. My fingers grasp her wrist. No, they won't. That's why we have to take it. She lets me pull her to her feet.
42. The Charter. Dilo, 3 months later. I've never appreciated how beautiful Norcia is in the summer. The grass glows impossibly green. The sky cracks open with blue, and the cast of Sailor's Folly sparkles over silver waves. A soft wind cajoles you into flight. Sometimes, I wake and wonder at how close I came to giving it all up. After the destruction of the Callipolan capital, and a subduing of the two great dragons, Griff Garrison prepared to return to Norcia. I'd told myself this was the last goodbye, that duty waited in Norcia for a king who must find a wife. I hid myself, wish him well, and I watched him walk away, wishing he'd turn around. Then I decided it was time I stopped waiting for Griff Gerson to find me first. I ran after him and said it, all of it. That I'd forsake my duty for him, but I couldn't ask that of him for me. That he was, as Mabelena had put it, the sunlight in my darkness. That I would remember him always, make king across the sea, and I hoped he'd find happiness with whomever he made his queen. I embarrassed myself soundly, and Griff let me go on like this for far too long. A bit of a smirk on his face before he finally put me out of my misery. "Dilo, you idiot," he said. "It's elective." I couldn't believe he'd interrupt my declaration with politics. What? The crown? When still I didn't get it, he pointed a finger at his own head and twisted it in a circle. "There's no need," he said, "for heirs." I saddled Jephira immediately after that. And when Astyanax found us about to launch and asked to be brought home, I pulled him onto the saddle with me. I left the twins with the letter to my father, formally recusing myself as his heir. I've yet to hear his reply. But I've heard from Feymi, and she tells me to be patient. You're still his favorite, you know. He'll come round. I can't spend my life waiting for that. Especially not today. Griff Gerson wakes crankily and slowly, sprawled across more than his share of the bed. And when he remembers what's coming, he groans and tells me he'd rather I rejoin him under those covers. So I tear them off. Becca lets me brush her hair. Sty shovels down porridge, and on another day, I'd send them down to school and let myself into Griff's study to organize his correspondence before, a little after dawn, we'd take the dragons out. But today, we have other plans. Becca and Sty lead the way, with skipping bare feet up the winding stairs of the citadel and into the Garden of Folly, where the next High King of Norcia will begin his coronation vigil. Griff walks alone to the center of the standing stones, and when his eye catches Becca's, he winks. For the next 24 hours, and the last time in his life, he'll kneel. And after that, we'll be here to see him rise. I once worried that reading about heroes of the old houses made me unsuited to the life of one. Now I know it does. In this corner of the earth that is mine, I will read poetry and grow old in love. Let them sing of others.
Griff. Kneeling in the Garden of Folly, fasting for one day and night, I look out upon the home that has been freed and the people who have become mine to care for. I once told myself it was for nothing, our revolution that cost so much. Now I know it was for everything. The citadel has been rebuilt, with the old Haeralian trappings gone for good. The clan's banners hang from the ramparts, all five. And down at what was Conqueror's Mound, now the Moot Hill again, we find a place to meet in council. The harbour, repaired, welcomes trade ships from Callipolis and Basilia, barges from the karst mines newly opened in the Folly, and trawlers bringing in heavy hauls. Queen Freyda, the first female sovereign of Basilia, is visiting soon with gifts of grain, and Dilo and I will welcome her with a feast. The summer's plenty overflows. I would have had Aga see it, her daughter's belly full, her lips moving as her fingers trace the first words of Norish, her smile as she climbs on my dragon's back. I would have had Grandas see me kneeling here, on my coronation vigil, before my anointing. But maybe they do see it. The sunset bleeds over the garden as the shadows of the clan castes grow long. A lone charter snakes its way through the folly, and I wonder, as I watch it, what Norsian returns from a northern passage. As the night passes, my shivering grows violent, and dreams seem to come to me waking. I remember Antigone, sobbing on the stone. Becca, her hair flopping like seaweed as she was dropped into my arms. A future, if I could only see it, past the grief that pulled like muck underfoot. Truth be told, Aga says, I knew this was coming since the day they gave you a dragon. With the dawn, the folly blesses me with rain. It drips down my head, down my face, and into my mouth. My blackened vision clears, enough for me to see my palms and the stones, the skies roiling over karst, and Sparker riding the storm with joy. Lightning flares and thunder crackles. The shrines have found me worthy. The sun rises, the storm clears, and the elders cover my shoulders with a flowing anointing robe and bid me rise. I walk barefoot with them through the citadel gates and down to the Moot Hill, where the clans spread below to hear the vows. He has been found worthy and would be your king, the one you have chosen among your elders. Will you follow him? The elders answer, and then the clans. We will. And will you serve your people? I will. Then bear the crown of the five clan stars. The five circlets are clasped into one and set upon my brow. Rise, High King of Norcia, says Bran. And then it's over. And Becca and Sty and Dilo are there, surrounding me. And Dilo smiling so wide his eyes are creasing at the corners. He gestures to the harbor, where a storm-beaten Haeralian charter has come into a port. It's the same one I saw snaking its way through the folly, and now, for the first time, I recognize it. The last time I saw it, the paint was fresh, where now it's faded. The wood had not yet turned gray with age, and I was only a boy. A lone figure has disembarked from the charter and makes his way up the hill. There's someone here to see you.
Annie. When Ayla and I finally return from Varsk, the city we find in Kallipolis little resembles the one we left in shambles after the Great Leveling. The rubble of the palace has been cleared, the foundations of new government buildings have been laid, and the Janiculum Hill has been vacated. The patrician families who were rendered homeless in the Leveling must decide whether to rebuild or to move on. Reconstruction was directed in its initial stages by Lee, but he's gone by the time I arrive, leaving the upcoming protectorship elections to be managed by Miranda Hayne. In the meantime, the Lyceum Club serves as our provisional seat of government. I remember being intimidated by this place in the past, when I was invited into it. But today, in the private wood-paneled room on the upper floor of the Lyceum Club, where I sit down opposite Feamy Skyfish, I know I'm not the nervous one. Before the Leveling, Dilo's sister and I had never spoken. The most I knew about her was that she and her twin were the ones who rigged the Norsian clan castes with explosives, and that, during Griff's uprising, she was widowed. Today she holds out a scroll with trembling fingers. She's written a document in both languages, Dragon Tongue and Kalish, and tells me she's been working on it since she left Norcia. It's a charter. Feamy proposes that the feudal leases on the freeholds be voided in perpetuity, and schools reopened under the revolutionary guidelines. The Triarchal Estates should have permanently circumscribed territory, and the Dragonborn families who have reclaimed them should be given a choice. Remain as custodians of their ancestral properties on behalf of the state, and give up dragon riding, or continue as riders and give up claim to their inheritance. A balance of power, a safeguard against corruption, the estates separated from the riders. I like the sound of this, but the details seem sticky. How would the riders give up their dragons? By widowing? No rider in their right mind would make such a choice. Feemy bites her lip, her fingers drifting up to rub the nape of her neck, and holds out a letter written in the looping dragon tongue of an aristocratic hand. My brother writes of a discovery in the north, made by a Norsian mariner, Griff Garrison's father actually. There's a place, a kind of haven, where dragons fly wild. The Norsians have stories about it. And Griff's father claims to have seen it. The Norsians call it the Star Springs. I didn't realize Griff's father was alive. A line of poetry returns to me from the epic of the Sky-Sung Queen. North, into death, to gaze upon the spring beyond the stars. I thought the dragons go north to die. Feemy shrugs. Maybe not. It's worth looking into. I remember the fear I had in that cell, that the separation I'd made with Ayla would be permanent. But if Griff's father is right about a haven in the north, then such a lasting renunciation might be less a punishment than a solution. Especially for riders who chose this life when they were too young to understand what they were giving up when they took their vows. For all we know, the dragons might like it better to fly wild too. Feemy proposes that those who choose to remain with their dragons, be they dragonborn, bastard, or lowborn, take the title of guardian and form a council of riders to serve the democratically elected protector. This seems fitting. Are any opposed? Feemy's brows knit. You agree, then, that the policy of guardians forswearing marriage and children should continue? I'm surprised by the question. Of course. Atreus's vision was flawed in many ways, but the desire to keep dragon riders from building aristocratic dynasties is one I've never questioned. Why? Well, says Feemy, a finger massaging her unbraided hair, the person that policy affects most is you. By some accounts, you are wed. It's the last thing I'm expecting, and all I can say is, oh. Feemy explains with evident hesitation. The paper trail is slight and inconclusive. Witnesses in the room at the time of your trial say you claimed it, but Ixion had that claim scratched from the official minutes. A property deed has been found in Harfast with you named as widow heir to Farhall, but no marriage record has been found to corroborate it. So, depending on the interpretation, Farhall is yours, and you are married to Leo Stormscourge, who turns out to have survived. Or it isn't yours, and you aren't. Whether you remain a guardian is up to you. My breathing has turned shallow. We have the deed, Feemy goes on. Depending on what you decide, we can authenticate it or destroy it. Naturally, I'd understand if you wished to think it over before telling me what you'd like to do. What I'd like to do. It sounds blasphemous. After so many years of living the life that chose me, now finally it's my turn. I can decide whether I choose it in return. I reach for an answer, and instead, for the first time since leaving for Varsk, find myself remembering the dream from the prison cell. Lee holding me and spinning me where we are nothing and no one. He told me once family wasn't something he wanted. But I remember the way he looked at me when he said that Farhall was mine to come back to, if I wanted it. That he'd wanted it in writing that it was always me. I would have had everything in the world with you. I wish I could have given it to you. What if it's still something we can have? Once, in conversation with Duck, I wondered if I had the chance to make the vows again, whether I would. You're allowed to be happy too, Duck said, and I didn't believe him then, but now, suddenly, miraculously, he's right, and I am. I'm allowed to have it. I'm allowed to have that house, and Lee. The joy my mother might have had that I have only glimpsed. I can reach out and take it. I can descend to earth as I fantasized in Farhall of doing, and join Lee on the ground. All I'd need to give up is Ayla, and the city spread beneath our wing. But at the thought, I feel I'm being shaken awake. A protest rises up in me, incredulous, and it sounds a little like Palor's growl. Sing to me, muse of the revolution's daughter. I remember the relief I felt at the sight of blood on my legs. I remember power pressing a badge into my hands as he told me it had been an honor. I remember Ayla's fire as she laid our enemy low, her amber wings glowing in the sun, the rightness we felt at our connection restored. I was at my lowest, as far from happiness as it was possible to be in that prison cell. But it was there that I remembered who I was and what I'd come here to do. And if I had to choose between this fantasy of a carefree life and the moment I rose to my feet with a poem clutched in my hand and Power's last salute lingering as goosebumps on my skin, my stomach is in knots, but not, I think, from indecision. Would you mind if I took a few days? There's someone I need to discuss this with. Of course, says Feemy at once. Take your time. After our meeting is done, I pack a saddlebag for a long weekend. I leave the city in able hands who can handle it while we're gone, but who will need us when we return. Then Ayla and I set off for the closest thing we have to home.
Lee, when I first came back to Farhall, it was only to build the Barrow Mound. I imagined it would be a kind of burying of myself. I had no plans for what would happen next. Annie was leagues away, managing affairs of state in a foreign empire, and the guardians who hadn't joined her were at work rebuilding a city I was ready to leave. I longed for fresher air, though it wasn't for lack of options in the capital. The people in the High Council would welcome you, Miranda Hain told me, and the charter Feymi Skyfish is drawing up would allow it. She was talking about the upcoming protectorate elections. I'd heard about Feymi's charter by now, a strict division between politics and dragons. I liked it in principle, and Rock, similarly freed from his vows, had told me he was considering it. It turned out that my widowing opened the door to politics in a way that life as a guardian hadn't. Palor's sacrifice set me free of the blood in my veins, the curse I couldn't get out, in ways I was only now beginning to understand. I don't think I'm ready yet. Well, give it a decade or two, Hain said dryly. A decade? It seemed like imagining a lifetime with 2 feet on the ground. What I itched for was the Barrow Mound, and I couldn't imagine what would come after, much less what would come after in 10 years. So I returned to Farhall. I dug the barrow, I laid the bones, I closed the door. And I wondered what would happen next. until Nigel Garth asked about plans to rebuild the big house. And I found myself looking them over. I was struck by how large it was. Obscenely grand for a single family, as I once told Annie, but not by other standards. In size and shape, it was not unlike Alban's orphanage or the cloisters. The rooms need only be divided and increased in number, and you'd have a different kind of home entirely. I found myself imagining other futures for this green square of land at the edge of the world. When Annie Suela arrives, our first reunion since they departed for Vask, I have the thought bubbling in my head like steam off the travertine. Annie brings herbs for a pilgrimage to Dragon's End, and the marble headstone she's had commissioned in the likeness of Palor's brooding features, to be set over the door to the barrow. Tilly, the grey mare I've grown fond of, hauls a cart bearing the headstone up the escarpments for us, and with Ayla's help, we set it over the barrow mound door. In dragon tongue it reads, "Here lies Palor Aurelian, who chose a storm scourge." Ayla curls at the base, and for a time Annie and I busy ourselves grooming the heather that grows around the door, listening to the gulls fuss on the waves. When the sun is low on the horizon, we make our way back down to the green. From the cliffs beside the partially reconstructed big house, we watch Ayla coasting level with us on the sea breeze as the setting sun spreads rosy fingers. I wonder if the dragon's remembering, as I am, that she once spun pinwheels over these waves with Palor. Her thoughts no longer mingle with mine, as they did for that strange spell in Norcia, where grief bound us. She's all Annie's again. Still, when she looks at me, our gaze locks the way it used to do with Palor. I lift a brow at her, and she flicks her tail in return. I resist a smile. So Ayla hasn't forgotten either. I'm about to share the idea that's been percolating half mad since I dug the barrow, when Annie speaks. "The estate papers declaring us wed conflict with the new charter. I need to choose. This or that." It takes me a moment to understand what she's referring to. I'd had the papers drawn up in case I didn't make it out of a burning building. But only now do I realize what their implications are for us if I'm officially alive again. I feel a fluttering in my heart and my fingertips. The blinding horizon that I once imagined in a courthouse bleeds into the sunset warming our faces. For a moment it's startlingly vivid. But also it already feels like a memory. Annie's mouth is rippling, unable to produce words, but I know whatever she needs to say herself. "Oh?" I feel like I'm attempting not to startle a skittish bird. Do you still? You told me once you never wanted it, was that true?" When she finally turns to look at me, what she sees in my face makes her eyes grow bright. "And you?" I ask. "Do you still want it?" Annie blinks rapidly. "Yeah, I still want it," she says, her shoulders drawn together, and looks away. I've got the seagrass gripped in my knuckles as the words pierce and twist. Like a deep stretch to the muscles, the pain mounts as it does its healing work, though I know this moment can't be endured much longer. She seems unable to produce the "but" that hangs over her answer. And for a moment, she looks so much like the shrinking classmate I remember that I'm tempted to smile. "But," I prompt. She speaks slowly and carefully into her knees. "But I have work to do." I feel a rush of pride mingled with a little bit more of that twisting pain. "I know." Could she think I don't know that? After what happened after Palor? Annie looks up, surprised. "That's why we wanted you, we want you to do that work." She hears his name in it and rubs her eyes with a sudden jerking gesture. Ayla veers from her coasting position and reattaches to the cliff face with a soft crunch. Her tail coils round us nest-like as she settles on the ground, and Annie's hand unconsciously finds her crest and squeezes. Her chin is rippling almost too hard for speech, but she gets it out. I figured I could still visit. Holidays like this, if you wanted. I mean, you might want to see other people, I'd understand. This nearly makes me laugh. Annie. She sits rigidly beside me, her eyes on the dragon. But when I slip an arm around her, she curls closer, and for a moment she lets me hold her. The pain ebbs, leaving me feeling drained, but my heart and head strangely clear. I feel a familiar scalding heat under my bare palm, and find Ayla nudging it, seeking my attention exactly the way Palor used to. Surprise catches at my throat as I begin to scratch her beneath her crest, where Palor used to itch. What will you do? Annie asks in a wobbling voice. I think I have work to do too. Our sides separate as she tilts back to look at me. Ayla's head tilts as she cocks an ear in my direction. Now it's Annie's turn to cajole my words out. Oh? I find my way toward it, haltingly. You know how the cloister was destroyed in the leveling? Annie nods. I've been wondering if there might be a better place to rebuild it. It began with remembering how Annie looked when she first saw the winterless green. The way her face smoothed and found peace in a way I'd never seen before. It made me wonder if other young guardians might find peace here too, far from the temptations of politics and power, in a place better suited to study and contemplation. In a big house, with lots of rooms, and windows that look out over the sea. Annie listens, her fingers tracing my palm, her eyes on the horizon. Who would run it? She asks softly. Well, I was thinking, I could. Maybe not yet, but when it's time. When we're ready. When I'm ready. Callipolis begins again. In the best, fairest version of herself, I think we would renounce dragons altogether. And maybe one day we will. But in the meantime, so long as she depends on their protection, dragons are her best defense and dragon riders must be trained. Atreus once told me I was his greatest mistake. And the more I think about it, the more I'd like to make a career of it. I'd have to get more of a staff, I add, though Nigel's a decent start. And I could get the other guardians to help for semesters at a time. Chrissa, Kor, the ones who'd be suited to it. Dark and Lena, maybe, which would also strengthen ties with Norcia. And you, when you got time off from your military duties, if you wanted. Annie's breath is slow and soft, her arms tight around her knees, and her silence makes me unexpectedly nervous, so I go on. I was also thinking, it's no longer about political leadership with the new charter. We don't have to worry about test scores or whatever else Atreus wanted. And in that case, preference for children to be brought for the choosing could be given to foundlings, orphans. So this could be their home, Annie murmurs. A better life for those who had no futures. She doesn't have to say, for kids like us. I nod, swallowing. And I've already got 3 eggs to start with. Ours. She's still watching that sunset, her face bathed in red, wisps of her auburn hair glowing. I can't read her expression, but when she speaks, her voice is thick. I think Ayla would really like that. The dragon's already purring beside us. After that, I lead Annie through it, her hand in mine, the foundations of the home being rebuilt, mostly roofless and slightly wallless. In the room that will be mine, smaller and more modest than the one that was my father's, I close the door, pull Annie onto my bed and remove her flame suit. Her lips trace the burn scars down my face, and mine trace the brand on her thigh. You came back to me. And you came back to me. Her lip curves against mine. Now, my lord, she says. Wasn't there something you wanted to practice? A little later, we make our way down to the travertine, with Ayla leading the way and Argos loping at a lazy trot behind. And in the wedding white sediment as the sun goes down, we bring the three dragon eggs to the steaming water, and Ayla curls round them to wait for her hatchlings.
This is Steve West. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Fury Song by Rosaria Munda, featuring Christian Coulson as Lee, Candice Moll as Annie, Aidan Kelly as Griff, and Anthony Mark Barrow as Dilo. This program was directed by Alan Tobin and Tyler Whitlatch. Executive producer, Nick Mottarelli. Edited by John Marshall Media. Text copyright, 2022, by Rosaria Munda. Production copyright, 2022, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.